You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1. Listen to Rootstock Radio every Monday at 5:30 p.m. on WAEFT Community Radio. Coming up next is In the Know, a web-produced public affairs show that highlights locally available resources. Stay with us after that for Champaign Urbana Radio Theater at 7, Monday Night R&R at 8, live local music on WEFT West Sessions at 10, and recorded local music on Champaign Local 901 at 11. We're going to do some quick underwriting, and then we are going to get to In the Know.
This hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and Paramount Painting. Paramount Painting brings quality interior and exterior painting services to the area with over 20 years of combined experience. They specialize in prep work to ensure the finished product is of exceptional quality. Chris and Dave are family men who enjoy supporting their community. Reach them at paramountpaintingplus@gmail.com or at 217-530-1086.
You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Welcome to In the Know. For listeners who have tuned in before, you know that this is a show where we talk about a lot of tough topics that don't always get talked about, or even if they do, not in a way that's more raw and candid, and that's what we try to do on this show. Tonight, I have Joby James in my studio. We're going to probably cover quite a few topics tonight around the work that he's done, the experiences that he's had. I invited Joby to come on and share his story because being involved in the local school district, I have parents who talk about some of the struggles that they see their kids going through, how they don't want them to go down a certain path, or maybe kids have experienced different things with systems, even the judicial system, and so how do we get them back on track? So I wanted to invite Joby to come on and share his story. So Joby, if you want to tell me a little bit about what you're currently doing, like what your current job title is, current work that you're involved in, who you partnered with, we'd love to hear about the great work you're doing. And then we'll do a little flashback to what happened before to bring you to where you are now.
Okay. I work for an organization called Truce. It's an anti-violence initiative geared towards ending gun violence here in Champaign, Urbana. I work with Ms. Patricia Avery. She's the executive director of a nonprofit organization called Champaign Urbana Area Project. Mm-hmm. And we've been collaborating now a little over 2 years now.
And so the work that Patricia does and then the work that you do with Truce, what is the outcome that you're looking for as far as making change in the community?
We want to try to get on the front end of the violence to try to prevent violence from happening. Mm-hmm. You know, we as an organization, we adapted the model of Violent Interrupters from Mr. T.O. Hardeman's Violent Interrupters program, and what we do is we interrupt the violence, and how we do that is by through social media, through building relationships in the community, word of mouth. So, you know, if an incident happens, we hear about it, we get out and we try to diffuse it.
Mm-hmm. So there's lots and lots and lots of statistics around all sorts of different type of, you know, community violence, gun violence. There's, stats that talk about people who reoffend. So share your story. Like, where did you start out? What have you experienced? Which systems? And, you know, how did it bring you to doing the great work that you're doing now?
Okay. I grew up on the south side of Chicago. Grew up in a kind of big family. I'm the youngest of nine children. Mm-hmm. I'm the second youngest. I have a set of twin sisters that's the youngest. My mom passed away when I was 3 years old, so I didn't get a chance to know my mom. Family got split apart, ended up being raised on my dad's side of the family. And my aunt, which is my dad's sister, she adopted me. So, you know, grew up a typical kid with my mom and my grandmother, my dad's mom in the house, but wasn't no male figures in the house. Only mm-hmm. male figures that were in the house, they were caught up in the gang culture and things of that nature. So, you know, I eventually, as I got, you know, as a teenager, start venturing out into the streets.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, ran with the local kids in the neighborhood. You know, we were beefing back and forth with other kids on the other side of the tracks, and I ended up catching a case in 1993 and got incarcerated.
How old were you then?
17.
Okay.
17 years old, ended up catching the case. Got convicted and was given a 40-year sentence.
Oh, wow. And what was the exact charge?
First-degree murder.
Okay.
I was charged with accountability. And I tell young kids now, they have this law that's accountability. You don't even have to pull the trigger, but if you are with some individuals and a crime happens, you're just accountable for that crime as the individual that actually, you know, shot the gun. So I got found guilty for accountability. Back then, time was 50%, so I had to serve 20 years. So went to prison in 1996. I had 17 years left. When I got down to prison, I had two choices. I could either conform to what's going on with the prison culture, or I could do something to change my life while I was in there. So just to back up a little bit, I was getting ready to graduate high school before I got incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got in, there was no programs. I went to a maximum security correctional center, Menard Correctional Center. They had no schooling, no nothing down there. When I transferred and left there, I went to a medium security prison, and they had GED programs, college. I got enrolled into the GED program, got my GED, enrolled into college, ended up obtaining my associate's degree in general studies, and multiple certifications, VOTEC certifications. Left there, went to another institution, ended up getting more certifications, and then got my associate's in applied science, my AS. Left there, ended up in Danville Correctional Center, and I was basically done with school. I was still able to take vocational classes, and then I ended up finding out about EJP when I was in Danville. Found out EJP was a four-credit college and prison program that you can work towards getting your bachelor's degree. So I enrolled into there, and it was awesome. It was challenging at first. You know, Rebecca always used to get on me like, you have to get engaged. I never, you know, I wasn't say like antisocial, but I didn't make too many friends.
Uh-huh.
Didn't communicate with too many people when I was in prison. So that form of education challenged me to, it was a lot of critical thinking within that program. So, you know, it challenged me to be more vocal. So.
And to kind of clarify, EJP is the Education Justice Project that's offered through the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana.
Yes, the Education Justice Project. And it was an awesome program. It really opened my eyes up to what I was finna look forward to once I returned back to society. So stayed in that program all the way until I made parole in 2013.
And you'd served how much time?
20 years.
20 years, wow. That's a lifetime.
That is. I always say I did more time in prison than I actually lived.
Right, yeah.
Because I was 17 when I got incarcerated.
Well, I think, you know, when you hear people talk about how, you know, you want people to come out of incarceration. You want them to be able to, you know, be a responsible member of the community. You want them to contribute. But there's a stagnation that can definitely occur once they're incarcerated. You know, what are they able to access? What services, not even just educational services, but mental health services, you know, all the things that we take for granted living in the free world. Although my 12-year-old just told me the other day that what's free about it. But, you know, all these things that are at our fingertips. You know, I actually was over at the Danville Correctional Institute or facility a couple weeks ago, teaching a financial wellness course to them. Because, again, we're not waiting until we get out to start becoming financially well and creating a financial plan to get back on our feet. But, you know, they were even saying we don't have access to the internet. You know, all these sources of ways to advocate for ourselves, and a lot of it's, you know, technological these days, they don't have access to that. But to kind of give an overview of the EJP and just how absolutely amazing the EJP is, you know, they even have their own radio station. They have 4-credit courses. They have writing workshops, reading groups, math and science workshops, computer lab, resource room workers, language partners, speaker series, the Prison Justice Project, mindfulness. They have all sorts of different things that they, you know, they work on to give not even just necessarily a leg up, but experience. You know, that's where that empowerment comes from, when you allow people who are incarcerated to not see themselves as a prison number, but a student, you know, somebody who's has value and is able to work towards that. So tell me kind of how you got hooked into EJP while you were there. You know, how did you learn about it? Did somebody say, hey, here's this opportunity?
I have a real close friend that I was doing time with. We have been doing time really since I had got incarcerated. His name was Johnny Page. And when I got to Danville, he was there. And he was in EJP. And he was telling me about the program. And I was like, wow. So, you know, I used to go up to the library, I would see what they were doing as a program. So, you know, I would duck my head into the resource room and, you know, speak with them. Mm-hmm. And I was like, man, this is awesome, man. Rebecca, at the time, they were taking, every year they take, you can apply for it. I got down there, like fall of 2010, mm-hmm. I enrolled, but I couldn't officially start until spring of 2011. And my very first course was Rebecca's reading group. And I was like, wow, you know, he is the director of the program. And I'm in her class. She's my first instructor. So it was very, man, I loved it. Once I got past her reading group and I kind of got the knowledge of how the program ran, I was involved in everything.
And something to add from, you know, being on this side of coming in, you know, Rebecca has an amazing way of that empowerment, even as somebody who is from the educational side, bringing it in to the system. Mm-hmm. She, you know, she really makes it clear that keep your mind open and you can learn just as much from the people you're teaching as you can impart on them, which I think is a great mindset to have, that you're not just going in and throwing information at somebody hoping that it sticks. If you keep your mind open and off, there's so much that your student can end up teaching you.
But see, what I found challenging about it was, you know, going through the community college, it was more, I always like to say it was more of a dictatorship. Mm-hmm. Because you know, whatever the instructor, you know, tell you to do, like you got to study for a test, study for exam, and then you take the exam, and then that's it. There wasn't no back and forth communication. So when I got into EJP, it was critical thinking dialogue. Mm. We would sit among each other and we would feed off each other. We would trade ideas. We would dialogue. And I was like, wow, this is awesome right here. So that, you know, that was what I loved about it. And I was heavily involved. I had got into, we had a theater initiative where I acted in 2 Shakespeare plays.
Really? That's exciting.
At the prison. And we had those filmed. Rebecca has them on, they're online. They're on the EJP website. You know, that was an awesome experience because guys within the prison that wasn't in EJP, we were able to invite some of them out to come watch us perform. Mm-hmm. You know, people had this perceived notion about Shakespeare, like, y'all acting out Shakespeare. Like, Shakespeare was a amazing poet. I say mm-hmm. some of his writing still to this day is, you know, mind-blowing. Where you read some of those Shakespeare writings, you'd be like, wow. Mm-hmm. But for us to act those plays out, it was awesome.
See, and I think even just that is not something anybody would think would happen within the walls of a prison. Yeah. I mean, I think some people would almost feel like, why would there be interest? And you know what I mean? Like all of these preconceived notions you have about people. And just the students who were in my class when I was teaching at the facility in Danville, their questions were just so well-rounded, and it showed the level of intelligence. I think there's this misunderstanding between education and intelligence. You don't have to have a PhD to be incredibly intelligent. Exactly. And so just their hunger for knowledge and trying to, you know, like they say, we have time. We have the time. That's not the issue. The time isn't, finding it to study or to read. We want to find out all of these things. You know, so many of them had multiple interests, and it was just awesome to kind of talk to them about that in addition to the financial wellness side. But even, talking just strictly about financial wellness, all of them, they had plans already going in their mind. It wasn't just sitting and doing nothing. They had plans. And so it doesn't surprise me that there are people who would have an interest in Shakespeare. Why not? Why not have that interest?
Yeah. And we had, that's awesome that you go down there and teach that, because the class that I had got engaged in before, Rebecca had classes come down. Like we had I think it was a financial literacy workshop. We had a real estate workshop. And I actually ran into the young man that ran the real estate workshop, because he lives here in the community. I see him all the time. He'd be on top of it. He like, man, come on, get in. EJP was awesome.
Mm-hmm. So, when you decided that you wanted to have this, additional education, again, because you have time, obviously, but what was the motivating factor there when you decided, I have the option of educating myself? It's not just, even for those on the outside, it's not just as simple as, I know I need an education. There has to be some motivation based on values.
Well, it was for me, I was always considered a smart kid. Like I told you, I was finna graduate high school. I had aspirations of going to NIU in DeKalb, Illinois. And, so that was my way of coping with doing time in prison. I educated myself. Mm-hmm. I didn't play cards. I didn't play domino. I didn't do none of those things. Individuals used to, have conversations about what they used to do when they was on the streets. I'd engage in none of those conversations. If we didn't have conversations built around what were we going to do to better ourselves once we got out, I stayed away from them individuals. So education was my escape to, I know I'm in this reality of being incarcerated, but education kind of freed my mind to where I was like, I can make a change within myself, because you basically have to rehabilitate yourself. They really don't have any programs to help you rehabilitate yourself. Especially when I was on my way getting ready to come out, and I know now it's kind of hard. Individuals don't really have, if you don't have no form of education, that's why individuals go back doing the same thing they do. And then they taken out a lot of the GED programs are taken out of the institutions, especially down south. So if you come in and don't have a GED and you're not able to obtain it, it's hard for individuals, even when they get to Danville, to get the EJP, because if they come down and they don't have a GED, now they got to go all the way through that whole process. So, because you got to be eligible, you got to have 60 credit hours just to enroll into EJP. But individuals that's been through college and they get down and they hear about EJP, they be excited. That motivates them to go and get those 60 credit hours so they can enroll. And they always have huge enrollments every time, every year. So, yeah, that education motivated me to want to come out and do better. I knew doing 20 years in prison was, like you said, half of my life would be gone. So I had to do something to change the narrative of just the stigma of the recidivism that goes with individuals that's incarcerated. They always say you got 50% that go back. I don't know. If you look at the recidivism, and they do have a study on it, you look at the recidivism of individuals that went through EJP, it's less than 0.1% of individuals go back. So that education does matter.
And that's a very, very, very important point to make is that when we talk about people who are incarcerated, we want them, like you said, to come, like people talk about all the time, we want them to come out and be able to contribute. When that educational piece is not available to them, when they come out, what are they coming out with? Essentially the same skills that they came in with, and who knows where when they came in the system. Mm-hmm. Like you, it was 17. Why would we expect you to know the whole world of adulting when you were barely an adult when you went in? And so it's so critical and crucial to have these types of programs available to those who are incarcerated, because if you know, again, they have the time, give them a chance to maximize it and be able to make the most of every day they're in there. You know, the students that I talked to, you know, their aspirations after they got out did not stop with whatever certificates or degrees they earned while they were there. They had, you know, the sky was the limit, they felt like. And that's empowering, having that education. Like they say, you know, knowledge is power. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of truth to that. There's many facets that you can look at with that. And just the empowerment that can come with somebody who knows that they're capable of learning and has the education underneath them. You know, like you said, it was, what was the rate? Point?
Less than 0.1%.
That's amazing. So somebody who has that knowledge is able to do more. So, you know, I'm sure people have asked you this question before, but I think some people just go based on what they see in the media. So what is the environment when you're incarcerated? You said that there's kind of the group that, hey, we're going to do something with our lives while we're in here. We're not resting on just being here every day. We're going to be something when we get out there. And then others, do you feel they're just resigned to whatever time they have to do, and they don't have any aspirations to look past?
Well, it kind of changed. Like when I went through the system in the 90s, I don't know. It's like individuals glorified going to prison like that was a stripe for them,
like a rite of passage.
No, like it gave them street cred that you went to prison. So you would see individuals come back and forth. But see, back then, prison was like, I guess individuals looked at it like a vacation, because the only thing you were missing, everything was in prison. The only thing you were missing was your freedom in the car. Everything else was in prison. It's here on the outside world. So, you know, individuals would come back. But once they tightened up, you know, I used to see individuals come back and forth though still after they tightened up within the prison. And I used to always ask them, like, why is it so hard? But goes back to education, you know, individuals just would come in and they would play cards and dominoes to pass time. And, you know, they would come in doing little bits like 2 years here, 3 years here.
Okay.
And, you know, I used to think that they used to just use that time to ways that they thought that they can outgame the system and go back and try to do it better, whatever activities that they was in, and they end up getting incarcerated. And, you know, when you catch the same felonies over and over, they give you more time. So individuals coming back, you know, doing more time. And but inside the prison, the culture inside of there is the individuals that you encountered through EJP, them individuals have been incarcerated 10 years or better already.
Oh, wow.
So they already have in their mind that, you know, I need to do something to educate myself. You know, you have a different mindset once you've been in there for a while, that your old ways, that stinking thinking doesn't occur anymore, because you got to have a mind-changing experience within yourself while you're there. You know, I used to watch individuals come back and forth, and I used to be like, man, just give me one time. It didn't take me 20 years to realize that, hey, I need to get out and make a change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some individuals don't get it. I used to watch guys come back, they would be in their 60s, and they would be telling me, like, man, this is like my eighth bit.
Oh,
I used
wow.
to be like, wow. I'm like, what? You got to change your environment. You have to do something different.
Right.
To continually to come back. But you have those two cultures. Now, like, people used to think we were bougie because we was in EJP. It's like, y'all think y'all better than everybody because y'all in EJP. People that wasn't in EJP, they used to think that. Because we thought different. We saw things differently than individuals that used to want to run around the wing and gamble and play cards and engage into conversations that wasn't productive. You know, our thinking changed through EJP. That's what I love about the program. It challenged you to think.
Right. Well, and like you said, I mean, why would they think that education is not, you know, the way they were looking at you as a student, you know, incarcerated? Like, this is your reality. This is what you're supposed to be living every day. You're not outside these walls as a student. You're a student inside the prison. So, you know, maybe even wrapping their minds around that concept that you could be a student even while you're incarcerated, especially if it's somebody who's been in and out, in and out, in and out, and had a taste of the real world. If they didn't prioritize education while they were out, you know, why would they prioritize it while they're in? I think that we tend to ask the question why people go back. You know, like you said, there were some people multiple times, and they're in their 60s now, and when did they start? You know, maybe they were the same age as you, and you have to wonder, what is it that causes people to go back to that lifestyle? And I don't think there's really always one ever specific answer, but you know, if people ask you why do you think people do that, what do you think?
I don't know. I think they haven't had no mind changing experience. Like, I have a friend that he's home now. He did 25 years, but all while he was incarcerated, he went in, he was 16 years old, so he did not have no high school diploma or GED. Mm-hmm. And he didn't obtain his GED none throughout that 25 years. He stayed in the weight room working out and played cards. And, you know, now it's coming back on him, because now that he's out and he's trying to get a job, you know, they ask you, do you have a high school diploma or GED on applications? Mm-hmm. And it's like embarrassment to him when he applied for jobs and he can't produce no type of GED or high school diploma. So now he's enrolled into GED class, but I'm telling him, like, and he have to pay for him. I'm like, you could have obtained your GED free when you was in prison.
What does he say? I mean, what reason does he give for not prioritizing it?
He got caught up in the culture of it, because you have individuals in there that's their way of just passing time, you know, every day, you know. Go to yard, work out, go to gym, work out, come back, play cards on the wing. So it's lockup time, then do it all over. Because you know every day what you're going to do in prison from the time you wake up to the time you go to sleep. You know, it's different out here. That's why I used to be naive to individuals out here when I was in there. Like, you know, my sisters used to be like, boy, we out here working out here. Mm-hmm. You know, so. And I tell individuals that now, because I keep in touch with individuals still that's incarcerated, and I be telling them, like, I understand now.
Right.
That your days go by fast out here. Y'all have a schedule in there, because you know from the time you wake up to the time you lay back down what you're going to do. Out here is different. You know, I may have to drive to Chicago to do an interview, or, you know, I may have a talk, you know, early in the morning, or, you know, you never know. Your schedule changes every day here. So I think he was just caught up in that, what was going on in prison. And then when it finally came upon him, when it was time for him to come home, he realized, like, man, I wasted all this time when I could have educated myself. Because, you know, we did time together, and he used to constantly see me going to school, going to work, going to the library. That's all I did. You know, I would work out, but I wasn't, you know, I wasn't no fanatic to where when they call gym, I'm the first one in line to go to the gym. No.
Well, it's about priorities at that point. There was a study, the U.S. Sentencing Commission released the results of a major study. This is back in 2016. And it said, of all the 25,431 federal offenders released in 2005, it said the older offenders and those with more education were less likely to return to a life of crime. It said the single best indicator of whether an ex-offender will become a re-offender is the length and the seriousness of his rap sheet. But these conclusions bear repeating, since they offer some guidance to policymakers who are most likely not criminologists. But it also talks about It said the most striking number is that about 45% of inmates are rearrested within 5 years of release. And this is considerably lower than the more alarming calculation of the Bureau of Justice Statistics, which says 77% are rearrested within 5 years. But the Bureau of Justice Statistics include both federal prisons and the far more numerous veterans of state prisons. So, you know, when it talks about the, you know, the offenses range from murder, rape, assaults, robberies, to, you know, drug trafficking. But, you know, the fact that it states what you've already said is that that education piece is so integral to whether somebody, you know, continues to live a life of crime or not. But, you know, we were in a trauma training a couple of weekends ago, and, you know, there was a speaker who came and talked about his time, mm-hmm. and what motivated him was his daughter, you know, how he was missing out on her life. And then he even said that she became a prison guard, and he asked her why, and she said, "I just wanted to know what it was that you kept choosing over me."
Exactly.
That's pretty serious. Yeah, you know, that's serious. One of those comments that you hear, especially when you hear it from your kids, and it kind of just hits you really mm-hmm. hard. But, you know, I think it's one of those things where everything is compartmentalized and people don't see the interconnectedness. How addressing one system can in a positive way can benefit multiple systems. So, you know, one of the things that I mentioned, you know, at our trauma training is the racial disparities that we have with incarceration and the justice system, even the juvenile justice system, and even the way we see disparities in our local school districts for who's punished and who's not. You add that to the school to prison pipeline and how that affects that, you know, how kids are treated in the local schools. But, you know, even the idea of helping those who are incarcerated and helping those who are reentering society, the reality is, depending on who it is, that could be a parent who has been absent from their child's life. I just forgot her name. The woman who wrote Orange is the New Black was at the University of Illinois a few years ago while I was in my master's program. And she was talking about the women that she became friends with and the fact that, you know, some of them had kids on the outside and some of them were trying their best to get that leg up while they were inside so they could come out and, you know, take care of their children. But even the concept that you have fathers who are absent from their children's lives, like the speaker was talking about at the trauma training, you know, that's impacting that child's life and that child's ability to, you know, grow up a certain way. And mm-hmm. again, when you choose which systems to reinvest in, it's not just that system typically that you're investing in. There's so many other situations that are touched, like the family court system or just, you know, family dynamics. There's so many things that the ripple effect creates when you prioritize, for instance, education for those who are incarcerated or having the right services applied when they try to, you know, reenter. What would you say was your biggest obstacle when you were trying to reenter?
Still being stigmatized by being a car. You know, you have these different individuals don't like to be labeled these certain names coming out. I was having a talk with a young man that I work with, and we were talking about far as the labels that's put on us, like ex-con, mm-hmm. formerly incarcerated, returning citizen. And he was asking me, like, you know, which one would you rather be called? And I was like, you know, formerly incarcerated sounds more feasible than being called an ex-con. And then he was like, well, I prefer to be, you know, called an ex-con because, you know, let's call a spade. He said, I don't believe that I'm no returning citizen because what am I returning to? Mm. And that goes back to, like, being still stigmatized from, because my thing is this here, once you serve your time, that's your debt paid to society, but we are still held accountable for the actions that we took, still out to this day, because they use your criminal background against you through everything, housing, employment.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, where is the returning citizen part at? If I serve my time, how am I a returning citizen? I'm not returning back to, you know, how life was before I committed a crime, had I not had a criminal background. So, and that made a lot of sense. So them are the obstacles that I face coming out, even though I've been able to get, you know, jobs and I'm working now, but still to have those jobs that, you know, I have the education to be able to work the jobs that individuals working that's making, you know, six figures a year. But because of my criminal background, that comes up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even with the housing situation, I'm working with a group now to do away with that housing because of that what causes individuals to go back. You know, when you come home, you want a place to stay. You know, of course, you're going to come out to family, but you want to get out on your own. So it's hard when you put in for a housing application and they automatically deny you because you have a criminal background.
Right. Yeah. So,
same way with jobs. They do it, and then they got this ban in the box, but they still find ways to get around that ban in the box because they still can technically ask you, do you have a background, and they can still check.
Mm-hmm.
And how they do that is them online applications. They don't even let you get past the process before you give them a consent to do a background check.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I had a very good job opportunity a couple of months ago. They had actually hired me. I went through, took my physical, did my drug test. They sent me my information so I can get my uniforms and everything. And they conducted the background check and they denied me.
Hmm.
And I had, when they tell you to put reference down, I had them call reference, and Rebecca was one of the people that they called. And, you know, they talked about my character as a person. And they were very excited, like, man, we can't wait to bring them on board with the company. And they denied me because of my background.
Did they specifically say that?
They said that.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of those continuing debates. You know, how long does somebody have to be labeled that way? You know, there have been ideas of, you know, if somebody is on parole or probation, you know, it's no different than you know, a job probation. You know, how, you know, somebody had suggested that let somebody come out, you know, give them, you know, time to prove that they can be, like you said, a returning citizen. If they mess up again, you know, then obviously there's strikes there. But if you keep putting that as what comes first, like you said, their rap sheet comes first before you have a chance to meet them or have a chance to see how they can perform, then again, but then this is the same person that you want to deny housing or you don't want to give them, you know, certain, you know, assistance from the government because of whatever's going on with them. And then, you know, why would they not choose to go back to a lifestyle that they know at least for some point worked? Yeah, I think that's always going to be a debate that we have and trying to figure out the solution to that. You know, there have been people who I've talked to, you know, parents in the district who've said, I would love to be able to volunteer at my child's school, but they will run a background check on you. And so some have said it's, I don't even want them to know that aspect of me. I just want to contribute to my kid's school. And so that's disheartening as, you know, a parent who's always tried to work to get parents involved, you know, get parents engaged, give that extra support. You know, one father that I talked to, he said, I can't find a job, you know, so while I'm still looking for a job, I would love to be able to go to my son's school because for the last 5 years, I haven't been there. And so I want to be able to go to his school. What can I do? What can I help with? You know, he said, I would be happy with fixing things the school needed if that's what they want. You know, he was just so enthusiastic about being involved. But he said, you know, if he was there on a regular basis, that they would need to do a background check on him. And he said that he felt like, he had also heard from another parent that, you know, if you have any felony on your record, they won't let you volunteer. And so that just...
No, that's not true, though. That's not true. Because I just found out, because, you know, I've been fighting to get into the school system to work with the kids. And that's how you know that they cater to this prison to pipeline thing. Because why not have an individual come in? If you saying that you got these kids in here disruptive and they are causing trouble here in the school, why not bring somebody in that's been there, done it already, that can reach these kids? And I've proven that I can reach these kids. You know, we just had a couple of meetings last week, or 2 weeks ago, where we sat down with a so-called group of kids at Centennial that they considered was the bad kids and that was heavily involved with some of the shootings that was going on out there. And once I told them my story, they gravitated to me. We had all these other powerful men in the room, but I was the only one that had ever been incarcerated. Once I started talking to them, they gravitated to me. Mm-hmm. Easily. And the same way as Central, we had kids and it was the same way. But why not have somebody in there to be a mentor to these kids that's been there, done that, but they have this barrier? But I found out that they can't, because they did. I went through the process, the application process to get into the schools. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, the school district here has a strict policy on certain crimes, felony crimes, that you can't get in and work with the kids. But I had went and did a talk at Franklin School, and Pastor Parks works there as a mentor with the kids, and I was telling him about the situation where they denied me. He was like, hey, they just denied you. They may can't put you on the payroll, but he says that there's nothing in the policy saying that you can't come in and volunteer. So he told me that you can go in and volunteer. Mm-hmm. You know, you just got to, you know, you got to talk to the right people. So that's what we're doing now. I actually have a huge event Wednesday at Centennial. Mm-hmm. Well, we're finna talk to like 250 kids. Mm-hmm. And we're, you know, we're hosting it. Truce is hosting it. And, you know, I'm working with Lindsay. Mm-hmm. Lindsay Aikman. She the one got me in there. Had a meeting with the principal and assistant principal, and they on board.
Mm-hmm. So what are you going to talk about at the event?
We're going to talk about this gun violence. And then I just heard about, like you was mentioning earlier, about the recent fight there.
At Centennial.
Yeah, mm-hmm. See, you know, that's where my organization could have been in it. See, if I was in the schools, I could have prevented that from happening, because word of mouth, it would have got out what was going on, and I could have got there and wouldn't have been none of that.
I think there is agreement among a lot of people, parents, community members, even teachers, that schools need more support. They just do. Especially when teachers are talking about behaviors that they see in their class that they don't know what it stems from. You know, we can't just keep saying it's a bad kid. That kid's going through something regardless. Yeah, they're going through something. Yeah. And so, you know, Karen Sims and, you know, you and I have all talked about how there's a lot of undiagnosed, untreated trauma. Mm-hmm. And it's not to say that the staff and the professionals in the schools who are the counselors and social workers, whatnot, aren't capable of helping. But, you know, how can you task them with helping an entire school when these schools are so big? And there needs to be, you know, sustainable effort to not just come in and help once, but to be able to see kids multiple times, because, you know, you need to be able, like mentoring, you know, you have to be able to have that continued contact to keep pushing them in the right direction, helping them see, like you've said, a different opportunity, a different option for what they might be used to or think is the only option. And so schools need more support. They need people who especially have experienced it and can say, this isn't somebody coming in and saying, don't do this, because we think this is what happens. It's somebody coming in and saying, no, this is actually what happens, and I know that because I went through it.
But see, this is the thing here. You have Karen that's a licensed professional in trauma training. Mm-hmm. And that is a great opportunity, because the teachers, they don't know how to detect it. So mm-hmm. they consider the child have behavior issues. And I totally disagree with, you know, putting the child on this metadating, this Ritalin, as a way of saying that this calms them down, they're this hyper child, when all of a sudden, you know, when actuality is just the trauma that they may have faced in their lives. But see, Karen, by her having that experience and knowledge, that should be taught in the school so teachers and social workers can be able to identify those problems mm-hmm. and can be able to address them. You know, me and Karen actually finna collaborate and we finna do something big, and I'm hoping that the school do not resist because she's gonna work with the families and I'm gonna work with these teens and we're gonna try to make it better. And I'm hoping that they don't resist because of trying to use my criminal background, saying that I'm not qualified mm-hmm. to go in when I've shown that, you know, if when I get to those kids, it's a whole different atmosphere. You know, when they see somebody that they can relate to and they hear the stories and, you know, and I don't do no scared straight, none of that stuff. Don't get me wrong. I'm just straight talking. I just tell them like what it is. This is what's going on. Either you're going to choose. My thing, I always tell them, you can choose life or you can choose death. Mm-hmm. Well, if you continue going down a path of destruction, you know, they have a place for you. There's only two choices, either dead or in jail. And I always say that, hey, man, you can make better decisions. You don't have to be, because that's what we're going to talk about, peer pressure and bullying within the schools. And I'm going to touch on suicide because, you know, I witnessed suicide from individuals when I was in prison because they couldn't handle
I think when we hear about gun violence, the first thing is mental health. It's mental health. So then the pushback is, if you really believe this is mental health, then you need to prioritize that in the schools, because the school teachers and the administrators and even the district administrators are not mental health professionals. Why are you asking them to diagnose something when, like you said, you know, trauma trainings that I've been to, you know, Karen's and whatnot, have said ADHD and symptoms of trauma look very similar. Yeah. And so we're saying, oh, no, ADHD, Ritalin, that'll put this to rest, when it doesn't. You know,
she and I... It actually makes it worse.
Mm-hmm. And so you talk about wanting teachers and administrators to be educated, but I think it's good to educate the students, especially those who have experienced trauma, because it happens so often that people who are victims of trauma victim blame themselves. They feel like, well, I did this to myself, or if I had just done this, or if I had just listened to my parents, or if I had just done XYZ, this would have never happened. And so they feel shame, you know, that stigma with mental health. I talked to a professional who is in with one of the other facilities here in town. They had attended an event at Centennial, and when they were talking about mental health and the feedback they got from students is, do you think that everybody can benefit from mental health services? And their response was, yes, at different points in our lives, we need extra support. Mm-hmm. And that's really what mental health services can provide, or just support in the first place when a child doesn't have that. So you have a kid who's experienced trauma, they don't feel comfortable talking to any of the adults in their lives. Maybe it's cultural, you just don't talk about it. Maybe it's stigma, you know, maybe parents just don't even know how to have the discussion.
And then it's judgment also.
Right. And so now they don't have any safe space to talk about what's happened to them, let alone get connected to a service that could help them. And you know, the thinking is, if you bring more services into the school, more opportunity to educate students, so there's not stigma even within them, they're, you know, them on that level, that what you see in somebody in class, understand that's coming from a serious place. This kid isn't just misbehaving according to whoever it's misbehaving to misbehave. They're experiencing something serious.
Something serious. Yeah. Yes.
Because there's a good chance they would probably say, no, I don't want to act like this. And I definitely don't want to have to deal with the consequences of it. You know, I want to find a better way to be this way. And so having more resources available to schools, I think, is really integral and very detrimental to the success of our kids. You know, even the parents who say, there's this kid in my, you know, my child's class and my child isn't getting the education that they deserve. Well, you can fix that. You can help fix that. Mm-hmm. You know, make it a priority. Write to your, you know, your district leaders and say, you know, ask, how can I help support these kids who need support? You know, how can we advocate for more mental health services or just services in general within our schools? You know, it's unfair that the school is tasked with having that responsibility, but that is the reality of the society we live in right now.
They need it, though, because the school is involved with more than half of your child's life throughout the day.
Right, right.
So, you know, my thing is this here. Do we really care about people? Do we really want to help folks?
Right.
Or are we selfish?
Right.
Because, you know, if you don't have a passion for helping somebody, if you're just looking like, okay, well, you know, it don't affect me. Even with the gun violence situation, a lot of people don't get involved because it haven't affected them personally.
Right.
When it affects you personally, then you get involved. You know, I don't know, man. I just think I don't know. It's just, I can't wrap my mind around it. You know, you have to have a passion and love for an individual for everybody to help, to help.
Right.
You know, when you're catering to, like you say, them systemic systems, mm-hmm. that's basically, like I was just looking at one of my friends was live up in Chicago, and they had, you know, they was out trying to talk to this alderman that's sponsoring this bill for loitering.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he's basically trying to tell individuals that they can't hang out in the neighborhoods that they grew up in, that they want to, you know, incarcerate these young men for just hanging out in the neighborhoods that they grew up in. So he's sponsoring the loitering bill.
Mm-hmm.
What is that? Why do you have to try to do something to try to add to the prison industrial complex? Because that's all they're going to do is just end up letting them build records as they incarcerate them for loitering, and you know that turns into other things instead mm-hmm. of just going out talking to them face to face, like, okay, what do you all need, you know, how can we help as a community?
Mm-hmm.
We got to get involved. Everything cannot be criminalized.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is criminalized with children.
Mm-hmm.
And then you set them on a path to where they feel like don't nobody care, so that's where the trauma comes in, and they start doing things that they thinking that's going to cope and help with their way to navigate through this life. And then the decision, you know, they end up making bad decisions, and we criminalize those bad decisions and lock away kids forever.
Mm-hmm.
When somebody could have intervened, and because kids need things to do. And that's what I plan on doing as an organization this year. I'm gonna get a group of kids, and we're gonna get up out of this community. I'm gonna show them that it's life outside of Champaign, Urbana. They need to see that.
Well, and that goes to the heart of the question. You know, when you want to look at human behavior, you know, as a mental health professional, you ask them what does a perfect world look like? How do you feel? How do you behave? It's not really any different when you're looking to your leaders and you're asking them, in a perfect world, what's the outcome you're looking for? So when we're issuing punitive measures and we're punishing kids, is the outcome that we want them to have a punishment, or is the outcome we don't want them to do that again?
Exactly.
Or we want them to learn from their mistake? And so is what you're doing getting them, because I think people think that that's all mutually exclusive. You know, there's these mindsets that if this happens, then this automatically should happen. Well, just because you punish a kid doesn't mean that they know. I was telling somebody earlier, you only know what you know. And so if a child like that doesn't have a real appreciation for why that's wrong behavior, especially when they go home at night, that's the behavior that's acceptable, or that's the behavior that's acceptable in their neighborhood, their community, then you have to be able to reach them on a different level. You have to be able to help them to understand why what they're doing is not for the best benefit of not just the school, but for them. You know, help them understand that they have better value beyond whatever you're seeing. But you have to be able to offer those sustainable resources to help keep them, you know, that thought in their head that I can do more than just what I've been doing. And I think that's where we see the disconnect when we're looking at the way we treat and handle things. Like you said, we can't criminalize everything. There's no way to do that. And how does that help anybody? That's just more money that the taxpayers are spending on something that if we get in front of it and spend money here, then we can teach better in the schools. So again, you're always going to spend money. I've always said you'll always spend money. It's either up front, being proactive, preventative, or it's in the back as a reaction, and it's going to be much more expensive when it's a reaction.
When it's a reaction, no doubt.
Yeah. Well, thank you for coming on my show, Joby. I mean, we're going to be talking about this kind of stuff for a while because this work never happens overnight. But if you had one message to send to listeners about how they can get involved, what would you recommend?
Just, you know, get involved. If you see something that's needed, if you see something that needs to be addressed, don't just talk about it. Get out and get involved. That's what I love about what the young kids are doing with the movement that they got going on, you know, behind that Parkland shooting. I was just at an event with them over the weekend, and they're doing some awesome things. Mm-hmm. You know, and they feel like, you know, that you know, the adults are not doing it, so
they got
to
do it.
They got to do it, but we got to get behind them. We got to get behind them and encourage them. You know, so I just ask people just to get involved. If you're in a community and you feel that your community is, you know, not on the right path, get with community leaders and get involved. You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm here in the community.
And we definitely appreciate that. Yes, thank you so much for the work that you do. I mean, like you said, it takes us to get involved, everybody, every single person. So thank you. You've been listening to In the Know on WEFT Champaign 90.1. Coming up next is Champaign Urbana Radio Theater at 7. Thanks again, listeners.
It's 6:59. You're tuned to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM. It's time now for Champaign-Urbana Radio Theater. On tonight's program, starting at 7 o'clock, we have episode 4 of Brass from Battleground Productions, a steampunk adventure. A reminder, of course, if you miss previous episodes of this show, they are archived for 2 weeks at Radio Free America. You can find a link to our archive from our website, weft.org. After Brass, we'll have an episode of Moon Over Morocco from the good folks at ZBS Productions. That's a Jack Flanders adventure, his second ever adventure, in fact.